From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, once known to you as Tony Solo, now known to be Stephen Sefton. Stephen, welcome, and what do you got for us this week?
So, hi, Don. Good to be talking with you again.
The same here, my friend.
Let's see how much of what's been going on over the last 2 weeks in the region in Latin America and the Caribbean we can cover.
We're all ears. Thanks.
I do think it's important to insist on what I regard as the main thing in the background affecting events in Latin America and the Caribbean, and that is the context of continuing U.S. decline in terms of its influence and prestige in the region, and the fact that it's continuing to try and compensate for the rise of China in the region. And because it's so desperate to try and maintain its previous ability to dominate the region militarily and diplomatically, it's the most important factor of instability in the region, despite the fact that its policy statements are always talking about the way other powers, meaning China, are destabilizing the region, or how Venezuela's destabilizing the region, for example. And that's a common theme in US diplomatic speak as regards Latin America. The main factor for instability in the region is, of course, the United States and its determination to intervene in the decisions of sovereign nations, seeking to prevent the peoples of the region from enjoying sufficient economic and political stability to be able to develop their countries and their economies and achieve a decent standard of living for themselves, for the impoverished majority. Whereas China offers investment, promoting infrastructure investment. It's that context that's really important. And in order to compensate for its decline, of course, the United States is extending its military presence, extending military cooperation agreements, extending the practice of military exercises, and also compensating for its decline by its indisputable ability to exert financial control across the region, which, of course, it has done historically for well over 100 years now. And more recently, over the last 15, 20 years or so, it's instigated this policy of what people call lawfare, which is the abuse of local judicial systems to attack progressive politicians in particular, but in general, any politician that doesn't do what the United States wants, by abusing the criminal justice system and the judicial system to get to achieve its political objectives. And of course, in Brazil, and what we've seen recently over the last couple of weeks is the annulment of the charges against Lula by one of the Supreme Court magistrates, initially on a technicality, but subsequently the Supreme Court plenary ruled by a majority that the process instigated against former President Lula, Ignacio da Silva, was not impartial. And they found that Sergio Moro was not impartial in his investigation, in the prosecution. And that makes it look as though the annulment of the charges against Lula, which are basically on a technicality to do with jurisdiction, might well stay annulled. And Lula may indeed not face the possibility of the whole trial against him starting from zero, which is one of the possibilities that it's still an outside possibility. And in the wake of the annulment of those charges, former President Lula da Silva went on a political offensive against Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, attacking Bolsonaro's disgraceful handling of the COVID-19 outbreak in Brazil, which has had very serious effects across Brazil. Hundreds of thousands of people dead, according to the latest figures. But whatever the truth of the actual figures may be, Lula is pushing at an open door with that particular line of criticism of President Bolsonaro, because the majority of people in Brazil agree that Bolsonaro has completely mishandled, in the most damaging way, the outbreak of COVID-19 in Brazil. So Lula has attacked Bolsonaro on that basis, but also, and perhaps more importantly in the medium and long term, it looks as though Lula may well be placing himself to stand as a presidential candidate in next year's presidential elections in Brazil. And I thought it was very interesting that in a recent interview he called for what he called a priority agreement between China and Brazil. And I think it's not unreasonable to interpret that as calling for a strategic agreement between China and Brazil, perhaps similar to what was negotiated over the last 5 years between China and Iran and finally signed. And that strategic agreement between China and Iran has come into effect. And really, it's armor-plated at Iran against further sanctions from either the United States or the European Union or both. And so something similar, if Lula can negotiate something similar for Brazil, that would be a huge game changer too for the Latin American and Caribbean region. And it's probably worth noting that shortly after that interview was published, there were major changes in the foreign ministry personnel with a Korea diplomat called Carlos Franco França replacing the previous foreign minister, who is an extreme right-wing neoliberal, very much aligned with the foreign policy thinking of the United States. And the general view seems to be that this new guy, Carlos Franco, is going to be far more independent and far more careful to defend Brazil's national sovereignty. And that's also the case in the Ministry of Defense, where the former defense minister, a guy called Luis Ramos, was replaced by a guy called, actually a serving military general, Walter Braga Neto. And both those appointments are seen as a big shift towards figures more prepared to defend Brazil's national sovereignty than their predecessors. And some people are interpreting that as a move by Brazil's establishment and its elites to compensate for what some people are interpreting as an abandonment of Bolsonaro by the Biden administration, because Bolsonaro is regarded as a political ally of Donald Trump. Now, I think that's going too far. It's ridiculous to say that the United States may have downgraded its relationship with Bolsonaro as an individual, but its relationship with Brazil and with the Brazilian elites is far too important for it to just walk away. What seems to be happening is that there's a process of renegotiation of the relationship between the Brazilian elites and their US counterparts as a result of the disaster that Bolsonaro has inflicted on Brazil. Before we go on to talk about what's happening in Venezuela and perhaps a little bit in Colombia, it's probably worth reminding people that the United States has long-standing military capacity in the region, not necessarily just by virtue of Southern Command and the Fourth Fleet that operate in the region. I think it's worth pointing out, for example, that the United States has bases throughout the region. For example, Guantanamo, it's got a naval base in Guantanamo in Cuba. It's got bases in Peru, Paraguay. It's got 7 bases in Colombia, a couple of bases, maybe 2 or 3 bases in Honduras, a very important base in El Salvador. And it has the use of facilities in Curaçao and Aruba. It can use facilities, it's negotiated an agreement to use facilities for its military in Costa Rica. It has an agreement to use a site in the Galapagos Islands with Ecuador. It has a new agreements with Panama, has agreements to use a Brazilian aerospace facility. And of course, it carries out regular exercises in the area, most notoriously in Amazonia, but also with Guyana threatening Venezuela's sovereignty in the context of the dispute over the Essequibo region. It does exercises with Chile and Argentina as well. So, and that's the context in which the Biden administration has talked about resurrecting Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia, the legacy of Plan Colombia, has been one of extreme violence by the Colombian state against the Colombian people. And so far this year, there have been 25 massacres. Dozens of social leaders and ex-FARC combatants have been murdered. with the administration of President Iván Duque doing next to nothing to prevent that. And that's the context, of course, in which the current combats are taking place along the Venezuelan-Colombian border, where Colombian paramilitaries are attempting to engage the Venezuelan armed forces in what effectively amounts to guerrilla warfare. And these paramilitary attacks are coordinated, with the Colombian military and also with organized crime. And that's particularly important on the Venezuelan side of the border. And so what you have is a very dangerous situation in which, and a lot of observers are talking about it as an accumulation of forces on the part of the Colombian army working in coordination with the US authorities, that are not just the military command of Southern Command, but also the Drugs Enforcement Agency and the other intelligence agencies of the United States that are interested in the region, of course, the CIA. And that coordination is happening between those US agencies and military authorities and the Colombian army and local organized crime and narcotics cartels. And there's also an attempt to implicate dissident groups of the FARC guerrilla who have taken up arms. There's a group led by an individual known as Gentil Duarte, who never signed the peace agreement. And there's also another group called Marcatalia II, which is composed of, or led by, former FARC guerrilla leaders who did sign the peace agreement, but felt that given the systematic assassination of hundreds of former FARC fighters and the general refusal of the government of Iván Duque to implement the 2016 peace agreements, they decided that they had no other choice but to take up arms again. And then, of course, there's also the ELN group, the Ejército de Liberación Nacional. I don't think the ELN is active in the along the border with Venezuela. So in that sense, the implication of the FARC groups in what's happening along the Venezuelan border, in particular in the border between Colombia and the Venezuelan Department of Apure, it's not really clear what the role of the FARC groups is, but it is very clear that the decades-old coordination between the US military authorities and intelligence authorities and the Drugs Enforcement Agency, the narcotics dealing Colombian paramilitaries, the Colombian army and the Colombian authorities in general, that is working very clearly now to try and destabilize the situation along the border with Venezuela, and particularly in that department of Apure. And I think observers are probably right to regard that as the initial stages of some potential kind of intervention to continue to try and destabilize the Venezuelan government on top of the vicious, sadistic sanctions that the unindicted war criminals of the United States government continue to apply against the Venezuelan people. So, obviously, that's something that we need to keep an eye on over the next few weeks. There are other things that have happened over the last 2 weeks that we should probably mention quickly. One was the visit by Bolivia's President Luis Arce to his counterpart in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And the salient point from that visit, apart from the development of cooperation agreements between the two countries, was that both President Arce and President López Obrador issued a very strong warning to Luis Almagro, Secretary General of the Organization of American States, against interfering in the internal affairs of countries and overstepping his responsibilities as the leader, as the Secretary General of the OAS. And that, I thought that was very significant, because it comes shortly after, or not long after, a conversation between President Alberto Fernandez of Argentina and President López Obrador, in which they agreed to collaborate together, trying to build up an axis of cooperation, promoting regional integration based on the interests of the sovereign nations of the region, and implicitly rejecting attempts by the United States to impose its priorities. And that visit by President Arce was followed up very shortly afterwards by the announcement that Argentina has withdrawn from the Lima Group, which is a group of right-wing countries that were set up after the United States and its allies couldn't get their way in the OAS, in the Organization of American States, to intensify sanctions against Venezuela from members of the OAS. A group of right-wing countries set up the Lima Group in order precisely to instigate sanctions and tighten the screws on Venezuela from within the region. But that initiative has now collapsed, and the Lima Group has been moribund for almost a year now. And so and that's the regional context too, in which there was a very tense meeting of the Mercosur Group, which was celebrating the 30th anniversary of its founding treaty, the Treaty of Asunción. Mercosur is made up of Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Argentina, and periodically goes through periods of conflict in which the fundamental interests of the different countries are interpreted differently. And over in recent years, there's been disagreement and conflict within the group about the issue of free trade agreements with other countries. And it's probably worth pointing out that Mercosur is probably the fourth or fifth most important trading bloc in the world. Its population is around 300 million people. Its GDP is around $4.6 trillion, according to the sources that I've checked. And obviously by far the most important trading bloc in Latin America and the Caribbean. So what happens in Mercosur is obviously very important in terms of the region, and to some extent reflects the broad contest between neoliberal free market thinking about economics and politics and the more progressive thinking of countries like, for example, Argentina, Bolivia, Venezuela, or revolutionary thinking in the case of Venezuela, and Cuba, Nicaragua, and so on. And that, of course, reflects a fundamental ideological clash between political movements and governments that follow the corporate-driven politics of the United States and the European Union, and governments that follow policy imperatives focused on the human person, which is the fundamental reason, of course, why the United States targets progressive and revolutionary governments in Latin America and the Caribbean. That's also something that we should probably keep an eye on to see to what extent it's possible for Argentina to fight its corner successfully in Mercosur. And if we look elsewhere in the region, we can see that that contest, that kind of conflict between popular movements, political movements determined to achieve better conditions of life for their country's impoverished majorities, are a key theme in events like the continuing protests in Paraguay, and in particular in Haiti. In Paraguay, the president there, President Abdo, continues to resist attempts to call him to account for his repressive policies against indigenous people, against rural communities in Paraguay. And of course, in Haiti, the protests are fundamentally over the refusal of President Jovenel Moïse to abide by the constitution and hold elections that were scheduled for February. Now he's talking about holding elections in maybe a year or two's time. And of course, that's completely unacceptable to the majority of people in Haiti who regard the Moïse administration as corrupt and illegitimate. And then shifting to Chile, there's continuing repression of protest in Chile, and that's in a context in which elections for the Constituent Assembly that was approved in a referendum last year, and those elections have now been postponed until May. They were due to be held early this month, and they've now been postponed until May on the pretext that the COVID-19 outbreak has made it too unsafe in terms of public health for the elections to be held as they'd originally been scheduled. And in Chile also, there are continuing protests by the Mapuche people, the indigenous people of Chile, to the extent that they're accusing the Sebastián Piñera government of engaging in genocide against their ethnic group. So there it remains to be seen whether the elections for the Constituent Assembly are in fact held in May and what the result of that turns out to be. At the moment, it looks as though the same electoral divisions that have made it possible for a right-wing government like that of Sebastián Piñera to take office, basically the social democrat, progressive, so-called progressive political movements, and the more radical left-wing political parties in Chile, find it impossible to unite. What that is like to lead to is a very unsatisfactory result in terms of the final deliberations of the Constituent Assembly for a new constitution for Chile. And you can see the signs of an unsatisfactory outcome in similar terms, in the sense that that political process is unlikely to resolve the deep-seated political contradictions in Chile. You can also see that in Peru. And in Peru right now, the first round of the election, it's almost certain to go to a second round. The first round of the elections in Peru, which is in deep crisis, it's in deep economic crisis because it's suffered a huge contraction of around 9% in its economy, in its GDP, as a result, mainly as a result of the COVID-19 outbreak. But it's also had a period of well over a decade of instability. It's going on for two decades now of political instability, which is very much a legacy of the Alberto Fujimori dictatorship of the 90s. But Peru's political instability has meant that one president after another has been caught up in scandal, in corruption scandals of one kind or another. And so the current election is being held but under the auspices of a government run by an interim president, President Sagasti, who took office as a result of a process in the legislature last November. And that electoral process currently has five candidates, all within just a few percentage points of each other, including a progressive candidate, Veronica Mendoza, run-of-the-mill neoliberal free market types, and an outright right-winger, Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of the former dictator Alberto Fujimori. And it's not clear at all who are going to be the two candidates that will go into the second round runoff. We won't know until the vote's actually held. And that's in quite sharp contrast to the situation in Ecuador, where the election process, after a very complicated and disputed first round in which there was a practical tie between two candidates for second place, which made naming the two candidates to go into the second round a longer drawn-out process than it should have been. The winning candidate of that standoff was the right-wing banker Guillermo Lasso. The loser was this phony, pseudo-progressive indigenous leader, Yaku Perez. He used to be a conventional candidate with a suit and a tie called Carlos Perez, but he reinvented himself with a ponytail and progressive trappings, riding around on a bicycle to present himself as this pseudo-progressive candidate. He lost the standoff with Guillermo Lasso to enter the second round. And called for a recount. His call for a recount was rejected. And so now there's a situation in which it looks as though Andres Arauz, the candidate who's strongly associated with the policies of former President Rafael Correa, is likely to win on the second round. His candidacy got a huge boost over the weekend when the president of the country's Indigenous Peoples Organization, CONAI, publicly declared his support for the candidacy of Andres Arauz. And then today, Monday, April 5th, his organization distanced itself from the views of the president. But even so, the president is a very influential figure and called for indigenous people to vote in support of Andres Arauz. And that incident reflects a division in the CONAI organization between, broadly speaking, between people who are prepared to look towards Andres Arauz to fulfill their aspirations as indigenous people, and people who support Yaku Perez and his brand of indigenous politics. And so it remains to be seen what happens. I mean, overall, the Indigenous Peoples organisations, led by CONAI, of course, calling for Indigenous people not to vote in favour of either candidate. But you can be sure that Yaku Perez will be following up his inclination to support Guillermo Lasso, the extreme right-wing candidate. And I think that's the explanation for why the CONAI president took the step over the weekend of publicly declaring his support for Andres Arauz. It does remain to be seen how that second round vote is actually going to go, because the corrupt current president, Lenin Moreno, has declared a state of emergency in 8 of Ecuador's departments on the pretext of the COVID-19 outbreak. So while it does seem unthinkable at this stage that the Ecuadorian authorities, either the electoral authorities or the government or the judicial authorities, will be able to spring a surprise to prevent the runoff going ahead as it should. Also on April the 11th, the same as the national elections in Peru. And that can't be completely ruled out, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Stephen Sefton, thank you very much, and we'll speak with you again next week. That was Stephen Sefton reporting from Managua, Nicaragua, on news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean this week. Up next, a report from the other side of the walls with America's longest-serving political prisoner journalist, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Virginia departs the death game. The state of Virginia, long the center of the American system of using the death penalty, has now, just days ago, abolished it. Virginia, the state from which most U.S. presidents have emerged, has been using the death penalty for over 400 years. But on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021, Governor Ralph S. Northam signed a bill abolishing Virginia's capital punishment program. This marked the first state of the former Confederacy in the South to formally abolish its death penalty. It marked the 23rd of the United States to abolish the practice. In Virginia, the death penalty dispatched some 1,300 souls over its long exercise. According to the New York Times, the 20th century of Virginia's death row saw 377 prisoners executed, of which 79% were black. That salient fact may have marked the legal formal end of Virginia's exercise of the death penalty. The governor told reporters, "Ending the death penalty comes down to one fundamental question. Is it fair?" New York Times, March 25th, 2021. The abolition itself seems to answer the question. But it's also possible that given the economic aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, states like Virginia faced serious fiscal challenges. For as businesses closed, tax revenues diminished substantially. Virginia shows us that even the death penalty can die. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.